Over.
Okay. Okay, that was Sunday, you said, right?
Roger. Sunday morning, 11 o'clock. We had it this morning, 11 a.m. And it usually runs about 2 hours, from about 11 to 1 o'clock. And we also, you know, stand by because we have band openings on 10 meters like today. We had a couple of old friends join us from Florida and a few from other parts. Actually, it was one of these, situations where the band opening was mostly due south, an equatorial type opening. So it was very interesting to have people check in, you know, to our local group from south. From the deep south, over.
Yeah, I think we should publicize the fact that 6 meters is open again. It's that summer season. I've been working Europe consistently from my car. I think I did it about 4 or 5 times already in the last week, so 6 is good.
Yeah, I got I was involved very much in 6 meters many years ago, but sort of got discouraged. There was a lot of times nothing doing, a lot of complaints, you know, with TBI and everything, and it just was a conglomeration of a number of things. So I took the, I had a 12-element 6-meter beam up on the tower, and I took it down. I believe it's still laying in the garage, and I don't know, 6-meter bugs didn't bite me since then, Barry, over.
12-element, 6 meters. Let me know what you're going to do with that antenna. That's my new project.
You were visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
New England reflector. Okay. Okay, Mel. Have a great evening. I'll talk to you about that 6-meter beam if you want to get rid of it. That sounds cool. N2MB in Rocky Way Beach.
Through the Telerex beam. I think it's still in the garage. Okay. Talk to you another time. This is K2KEY. Good night, all.
Night, Mel.
73
now. 87
VAW.
West Elevation of right now. Somewhere, I think, in the field. Okay, yeah, when I cross course, then I'll look down or up, as it were, to prospect. K1RSA, K1RSA.
KD7DAW in Florida, listening.
Thank you.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Amateur Radio Newsline report number 1713 with a release date of Friday, June 11, 2010, to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. The International Telecommunications Union will investigate interference from VPL when it meets in Geneva. The FCC denies a petition to change the basis and purpose of amateur radio. A massive rewrite of the Part 95 rules governing GMRS and CB radio is proposed. And a New York State ham gets ready to fight a citation he received for operating mobile with an HT. Find out the details on Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1713 coming your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's first independent on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now, reporting, here is Don Wilbanks, AE5DW.
The International Telecommunications Union's working parties, 1A and 1B, will meet in Geneva, Switzerland between June 21st and 28th. A major item of discussion will be the protection of radio services from interference caused by broadband over power line, or BPL. Amateur Radio Newsline's Bruce Bennett, K6TZW, is a preview of what to expect. Bruce.
The International Amateur Radio Union, or IARU, has already contributed to a report titled The Impact of Powerline Telecommunication Systems on Radio Communication Systems Operating in the Low Frequency, Medium Frequency, High Frequency, and VHF Bands Below 80 MHz. In it, the acceptable criteria for degradation of the high frequency radio noise floor caused by BPL is defined as being 1/2 of 1 dB. Now this group will concentrate on the protection of radio services from the effects of BPL in the range of 80 to 200 megahertz. The IARU delegate to the SG1 and its working parties is Peter Chadwick, G3RZP. He says that three input contributions have been prepared for this meeting. The first of these is a report on the effects of intermodulation in power supplies causing the amateur band frequency notches in the BPL spectrum to be degraded. This report's been prepared from the work by Richard Marshall, G3FBA. It goes so far as to point out the difficulties such effects could have on BPL system itself. A further input establishes protection criteria for amateur stations operating in the 2-meter band. Ian White, GM3SEK, contributed to it. It finds that the amateur and amateur satellite services require protection, such that BPL interference does not exceed the level of 4.5 dB per meter in the main lobe of the antenna. This with a separation between antenna and the PTL installation at least 10 meters. The third input is of more general nature. It shows that there are a number of non-amateur services that could suffer interference from BPL or its harmonics. These include alarms for the elderly, pagers, medical implant telemetry, as well as broadcasting. And when accumulation of radiation from BPL and other sources is added together, aircraft navigation and communications could be negatively impacted as well. From the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Bruce Tennant, K6TZW in Los Angeles.
Summing it all up, the reports conclude that when the differences in range between BPL devices versus the other spectrum users are taken into account, the acceptable levels of radiation to protect the amateur service users are of the same order as those needed to protect the other services. Meantime, wide area access BPL will soon likely be extinct in Australia. The latest appraisal of broadband over power lines has been cautiously described as appearing to have all but vanished from the Australian telecommunications landscape. That's the view of Wireless Institute of Australia BPL Working Group Chairman Phil Waite, VK2DKN, who also observed that the use of access BPL in the United States is diminishing rapidly, with the latest BPL shutdown occurring in the city of Manassas, Virginia. And while there have been 8 access BPL trials in Australia since 2004, the last of these appears to have been terminated back in 2007. While BPL using power lines as an internet-enabling technology has apparently failed, in-house BPL using the internal wiring of a home or building is now the major market for BPL equipment manufacturers. In the United Kingdom, more than 800,000 pairs of in-home BPL modems have been installed by British Telecom. This has brought continuing interference complaints to the UK regulator Ofcom, which according to VK2DKN appears to be unable, or at least very reluctant, to act. To make matters worse for UK radio amateurs, it appears that one type of in-house BPL adapter can emit a radio frequency signal up to 370 megahertz. While BPL may be on the decline in Western nations, it seems to be gaining a new foothold in the Middle East. This was news that Egypt-based Saba Electric is getting into the Broadband Over Power Line Act. Jim Linton, ZK3PC, reports that Saba has formed a partnership with ISPlink.net and has planned for easy access to the Internet through BPL. In a media statement, Saba Electric said BPL is the technology it will use to provide broadband data speed up to 8 megabytes per second, and that includes a number of voice over Internet protocol and video options. The completed system will reach over 300,000 residents. The FCC has turned away a rules change request from Gordon Schlesinger, W6LBV of San Diego, California, one that sought to partially rewrite Section 97.1 of the amateur service rules. Section 97.1 deals with the very basis and purpose of ham radio. In his September 2008 filing, Schlesinger claimed that Section 97.1 is outmoded due to changes in technology and practices and that it diverges from the practical realities of the amateur service today. In denying Schlesinger's request, the FCC stated that the basis and purpose of the amateur service was not intended to reflect any particular technology or the practices of a particular time. Rather, Section 97.1 is intended to provide guidance as to the accomplishments the Commission expects of the service and to assist in international negotiations affecting the service. In closing, the FCC notes that nothing in Schlesinger's petition demonstrates that the Commission's expectations for the amateur service have changed or are not being met, or that the rule is in some way hampering international negotiations that affect the amateur service. Nor does this petition identify any reason to revisit the Commission's decision on the matter made back in 1989. At that time, the FCC decided that it was in the best interest of the hobby not to change the basis and purpose of the Part 97 amateur service. The FCC is proposing a massive rewrite of its Part 95 rules. These are the regulations that govern such publicly available two-way radio as the General Mobile Radio Service, the Family Radio Service, and 11-meter CB, to mention only a few. WT docket number 10-119 was released on June 7th. And is a catch-all of proposed rules changes that would affect the General Mobile Radio Service the most. This by ending its current licensing requirements and replacing these with what the FCC calls license by rule. That's an FCC term that kind of means doing to GMRS what it essentially did on 11-meter CB a few decades ago. It would additionally mean relaxing GMRS eligibility requirements and at the same time implementing mandatory 12.5 kHz channel spacing to the service. Would also allow the transmission of global positioning system location information and user-generated text messages on certain GMRS channels. As to the Family Radio Service, the FCC proposes to prohibit the authorization of radios that combine FRS with other safety-related services. In other words, an FRS radio would have to be a Family Radio Service-only transceiver, and it would become illegal to manufacture an FRS radio that could work with or in any service other than channels where FRS is allocated to operate. This would mean an end to a whole slew of transceivers that have multiple service capability, especially those that cover both FRS and GMRS, or some with FRS, GMRS, and marine channel capability. Regarding 11-meter CB, the FCC says it plans to evaluate several requirements regarding the Citizens Band radio service in order to determine whether they are all still needed. Of significance, the FCC will be looking into CBers who work skift during band openings. It notes that amplifiers for CB stations are already illegal, but WT docket number 10-119 asks if the regulatory agencies should consider prohibiting directional antennas for CB operations in order to promote the service's intended use for short-range-only communications. It also wants to know if it should consider power reductions for the CB service and whether or not to permit the use of hands-free microphones. FCC WT docket number 10-119 is 96 pages long, including various appendices. It also carries a rather short commentary cutoff date of 30 days after publication in the Federal Register. Reply comments will be due 45 days after publication in the Federal Register. You can download it and read it yourself at the URL on this week's printed Amateur Radio Newsline report. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline. Heard on bulletin stations around the world, including the W4KEV repeater serving Knoxville, Tennessee. Amateur radio operators in upstate New York are up in arms over a traffic ticket handed to Steve Bozak, WB2IQU, while he was operating mobile in the city of Troy. And Bozak is ready to force the issue in court. Amateur Radio Newsline's Norm Seeley, KI7UP, has more.
A 34-year veteran of the hobby, Steve Bozak, WB2IQU, owns an antenna company and is well known in the upstate New York area. Recently, he was pulled over at an intersection while on his way to breakfast with fellow ham radio enthusiasts. He was then issued a ticket for talking on a cell phone while driving after Officer Mark Billington dismissed Bozak's claims that the radio was not, in fact, a telephone. The section of New York's vehicle and traffic law Bozak was cited for violating is designated as 1225C. It requires a phone to be in the immediate proximity of the driver's ear. It also defines the type of communication devices it applies to as ones interconnected to a public switch telephone network provided by a commercial mobile radio service. But Bozak was not using a cell phone. He was using a small Kenwood HT that is in no way even remotely similar to a cell phone. And on its face value, the statute does not refer to devices like ham radio transceivers that independently transmit a signal with no telephone interconnection. Sergeant Terry Buchanan is the police department spokesman who's worked traffic patrols for years. He says that he doesn't recall the issue coming up in the past. He said that the department would have no comment on the matter because it's still pending in court. Bozak is scheduled to appear on June 23rd, but that date could be pushed back because Bozak has decided to force the issue. As a start, he has requested a supporting deposition from Officer Millington, who is typically assigned to Troy's public schools and rarely works traffic patrol. Bozak wants Millington to specifically detail what happened and explain how he was breaking the law. And when the case does come up to a hearing, more than a dozen local Troy area hams plan on being there with him. For Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Norm Seeley, KI7UP in Scottsdale, Arizona.
If he loses in court, Bozak faces a $100 fine. A loss might also cause other hams in New York State to face similar citations simply for operating mobile, as they have since ham radio first began. A Connecticut ham has been arrested in connection with an incident that occurred at a Walmart in Norwich this past January. The May 28th issue of the Norwich Bulletin reports that Keith J. Much of Norwich has been charged with second-degree breach of peace, first-degree reckless endangerment, and falsely reporting an incident in the first degree. According to the FCC database, Much holds the call KB1RBI. By way of background, back on January 26th, Norwich police responded to a report of a man in front of the local Walmart who was armed with a shotgun and was threatening to shoot people. On their arrival, it was determined the report was false and no one was injured. Initial investigation by police revealed that store security personnel had heard the report of the man with the shotgun over their two-way radio system. However, none of the personnel had made the transmission. A police investigation concluded that Much had used a portable ham radio set to make the transmission. The Australian Communications and Media Authority, better known as the ACMA, has canceled the amateur radio station license of an unnamed ham following an investigation that uncovered continuing breaches of that nation's amateur service by the licensee. In this case, the violations included causing interference to other stations, failing to use a call sign, and transmitting an unmodulated carrier. The ACMA made the decision to cancel the amateur license when other compliance and enforcement measures had failed. The regulatory agency says in its reporting on the matter that every effort had been made to assist, encourage, and educate the licensee to understand the importance of compliance with license conditions. Despite repeated warnings to the licensee, the ACMA found that noncompliance continued over an extended period of time. Under the Australian Radio Communications Act of 1992, the ACMA can suspend or cancel an amateur license if the holder contravenes the condition of the license. In the case of the recent cancellation, crucial information was provided by other radio amateurs that alerted the ACMA to the ongoing non-compliance and assisted the investigation. Under Australian privacy laws, the name of the ham who had his license revoked was not revealed. W6ZL has canceled its current A35KL operation from Tonga. David decided to leave Tonga on June 2nd and return to California after his guest house room was burglarized last weekend. He says that he may be back in Tonga for the CQ Worldwide contest later this year. While the D-Star protocol developed by the Japan Amateur Radio League is open and freely available for use by anyone, the AMBE voice encoding scheme currently used by the D-Star protocol is not. Rather, it is patented by DVSI Incorporated, and its licensing fee is one of the factors in the higher cost of a D-Star radio over a similar analog FM unit. But that could change if one Australian ham has his way. Development of an open-source, freely available alternative to AMVE is being spearheaded by David Rowe, VK5DGR. This open-voice protocol is called Codec 2. Right now, it is in a highly experimental stage, but has several advocates in open-source software circles. Rowe says that a D-Star protocol implementing Codec 2 digital voice would significantly drop the entrance-level costs to the mode and appeal to a much wider audience. He says that once Codec 2 is stable and competitive, it would offer a real, developed by a ham alternative to the patented AMVE voice encoder. You can find out more about Codec 2 at David Rowe's development site. It's in cyberspace at tinyurl.com/2362N3T. According to its public relations director, Henry Ruminsky, W8HJR, the official attendance for Hamvention 2010 was 19,750. This continues the upward trend began last year when 18,877 were counted going through the gate at the Hera Arena, following the 2008 record 10-year low figure of 17,253. While this is a good positive direction, it's also still a long ways from the 10-year record headcount of 28,804 set back in 2000. The all-time record Hamvention attendance was set in 1993 when 33,669 radio amateurs from around the world made their way to Dayton, Ohio for this annual Ham Radio Rite of Spring. AMSAT has announced that its 2010 Space Symposium and annual meeting will be held on Friday, October 8th through Sunday, October 10th. This year's venue is the Chicago area Elk Grove Holiday Inn, which is near O'Hare Airport. This is the same hotel that recently hosted the Central States VHF Conference and W9DXCC events. AMSAT has also put out a call for papers to be presented at the symposium. These can be on any topic of interest to the amateur satellite community. A final copy must be submitted by September 1st for inclusion in the printed proceedings. Abstracts and papers should be sent via email to k9jkm@amsat.org. The North Texas Microwave Society will hold the 14th International EME Conference in Dallas, Texas on August 12th to the 14th. Gerald Youngblood, K5SDR, President and Chief Executive Officer of Flex Radio, will be the lunchtime speaker Friday, August 13th. And Nobel laureate Joe Taylor, K1JT, will speak about the 432 MHz EME event at Arecibo on Saturday, August 14th. Presentations will also include a noise figure workshop hosted by Al Ward, W5LUA, Tommy Henderson, WD5AGO, and Tony Emanuel, WA8RJF. This is the first time the conference is to be held in the U.S. since 2004. Nicole Ledoux Levy, the widow of the late Larry Levy, WA2INM, has asked that we pass along the following information. In lieu of flowers, donations in Larry Levy's name can be made to the Cornell Feline Health Center for the William Ledoux Fund, College of Veterinary Medicine, Hungerford Hill Road, Ithaca, New York, 14863. As we reported last week, WA2INM died of a massive heart attack on Sunday night, May 30th. In the world of electronics, he was best known as the developer of sound-controlled entertainment lighting and as the contributor to the design of the original IBM personal computer. He went on to become a world champion cat breeder with offices in New York and Paris. This is Ham Radio News for today's radio amateur. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline with links to the world from our only official website at www.arnewsline.org and being relayed by the volunteer services of the following radio amateur. An astronaut on board the United States Space Station has sent congratulations to the Wireless Institute of Australia on the latter's 100th anniversary. In her message beamed to the banquet celebrating the organization's centenary, astronaut Tracy Caldwell Dyson, KF5DBF, said that the WIA and communications itself had come a long way over the past 100 years.
On behalf of the International Space Station crew and NASA, I extend our warm congratulations to the Wireless Institute of Australia on reaching 100 years. The WIA began in 1910 at a time when we could not communicate around the world using radio. About a decade later, radio amateurs had developed worldwide radio communications. Among the many other contributions of radio amateurs over the years include space communications. The first amateur satellite was launched in 1961, just 4 years after Sputnik 1.
Astronaut Caldwell Dyson's remarks were warmly received by all of those attending the special WIA 100th anniversary dinner. Emergency search and rescue workers in rugged rural areas may never lose a cell phone call again. This thanks to a new antenna developed by Montana State University researchers in collaboration with Advanced Acoustic Concepts, Incorporated. The Montana State University antenna is considered a smart or adaptive array antenna because it uses computer technology to automatically aim the message transmission beam in the right direction, chooses the most appropriate signal strength, optimizes the strength of transmitted beams, and adapts to the environment. The automatic control allows users to communicate in rugged terrain while on the move. Unlike normal omnidirectional antennas, smart antennas maintain a direct signal between individual users and cell sites. This will likely mean fewer dropped calls and the ability to move more data, such as streaming video. You can read more about this antenna online at tinyurl.com/2CWAD9M. NASA has unveiled an interactive computer simulation that allows virtual explorers of all ages to dock the space shuttle at the International Space Station, experience a virtual trip to Mars, or a lunar impact. It also allows users to explore images of star formations taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. In an effort to excite young people about space and NASA's missions, the agency has launched its online Space Communication and Navigation, or SCAN, simulation. The interactive simulation offers a virtual 3D experience to visualize how data travels along various space communications paths. The interactive space communication and navigation simulation allows visitors to select spacecraft and experience a fly-through or a tutorial with images and descriptions of NASA's three space communications networks. The space network fly-through also shows how data is relayed from NASA's White Sands Test Facility to the space station via the tracking and data relay satellite system. This is a network of communication satellites and ground stations NASA uses for space communications. Finally, in the Deep Space Network demonstration, visitors learn how NASA communicates with the Mars exploration rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, by using the Madrid Deep Space Network antenna. This to send data to the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which then relays the data to the rover. To explore the Space Communication and Navigation Network simulation, please take your web browser to the URL in this week's printed Amateur Radio Newsline report. The images from cameras and sensors on the recently launched Solar Dynamics Observatory satellite are a dramatic reminder of the power of the star that warms our planet. Since the spacecraft and its instruments were officially commissioned on May 14th, more than 5 million images have been transmitted back to Earth. Some show clouds of magnetized gas big enough to engulf the Earth, breaking away from the outermost layer of the Sun. These coronal mass ejections, which are usually accompanied by solar flares, can last for several hours and travel through space at over 1 million kilometers per hour. Coronal mass ejections usually take about 3 days to reach Earth, but very fast ones can arrive in under a day. And as they penetrate the Earth's ionosphere, the charged particles and magnetic forces emit radiation across the electromagnetic spectrum, from low-energy radio waves through to high-energy gamma rays. NASA launched the Solar Dynamics Observatory satellite in February to gain a better understanding of how the Sun behaves and why, and also to keep a closer watch on space weather. About 70,000 images will be radioed back to Earth each day during the expected 5-year life of this on-orbit bird. Millions of documents stored at the United Kingdom's World War II Codebreaking Center, Bletchley Park, will soon be made available online. This after Hewlett-Packard donates a number of scanners to the center in Milton Keynes, so volunteers can begin the task, which is expected to take over 3 years. The entire story is available online at tinyurl.com/3x2cfz6. ICOM Australia has donated a new D-Star repeater to the Wireless Institute of Australia for installation in the Canberra area. Canberra Region Amateur Radio Club will be the D-Star group responsible for the installation and operations of the repeater on behalf of the WIA. The repeater will be operational on 2 meters using port C and have the call sign of VK1RWN. The time frame for the installation and operations of the new D-Star system is yet to be determined. The announcement of this donation was made by Takashi Aoki, manager of ICOM Australia, at the official WIA centenary dinner on Saturday night, June 5th. This donation from ICOM was made to celebrate 100 years of the WIA. In DX, where the W0SD, W0OE, N0QJM, and W7XU will be operating in Gambia, portable C5 from June 25th to July 6th. Their main focus will be 6 meters with plans to remain on 50.103 megahertz. They'll have a portable amplifier coupled to a large Yagi from a seaside location and will have a breakable beacon, QSL as directed on the air. G4AHK is now active as 7Q7BJ from Malawi. It will be on the air until June 22nd. That's enough for him on 160, 80, and 40 meters, QSL via his home call sign. ZL1DA will be active stroke FJ from St. Bartholomew Island between June 8th and the 20th. Activity will mostly be on 40 through 6 meters using CW and RTTY. QSL him also via his home call sign. Lastly, N2NL will be returning to Guam June 17th and will be there for 3 years. She'll be active outside of contest as KH2 stroke N2NL and during contest as NH2T, USL via logbook of the world or via W2YC. And finally, this rather bizarre follow-up to our story 2 weeks ago concerning a South African ham who spotted a super-secret United States military spy plane as it circles the globe. Now a local newspaper is deeming him to be a threat to the security of the United States because of his accomplishment and those of his friends who helped him. Amateur Radio Newsline's Bill Pasternak, WA6IDF, has the rest of this rather unique tale. Bill.
South African retiree and amateur astronomer Greg Roberts, ZS1BI, says that he and his group have been labeled as a threat to the United States' national security. This after he, with the aid of other amateur astronomers worldwide, seems to have successfully located and recorded images of the U.S. Air Force's secret X-37B spacecraft on orbit. The South Africa Sunday Times reports that with the help of the group of amateur astronomers from around the globe, including a gasoline station attendant in Canada, that Roberts calculated the top-secret spacecraft took about 92 minutes to orbit Europe. Also, that it flies over such hot spots as Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and Korea. The discovery of the craft, which is 8.9 meters long and travels at 8 kilometers a second, earned Roberts a mention in the New York Times, on the BBC, and even in several science publications. As a result, Roberts says that he and his group have been labeled as a threat to the national security of the United States by the U.S. Congress. He and his wife now joke that the proverbial men in black will one of these days walk up his driveway. But not everybody looks at Roberts' work in that way. Dr. Ed Elson is a researcher at the University of Cape Town's Department of Astronomy. He lauded Roberts and the group of amateur astronomers. Elson says that the fact that they managed to find the X-37B and are now tracking the craft is certainly quite an admirable feat, especially from an observational astronomer's perspective. Dr. Elson added that Roberts and his team certainly have a very respectable track record, claiming to be tracking almost every classified object that has ever been launched, well, at least in the past 5 years. Because of this, Elson sees no reason to refute the claim of Roberts having found the X-37B. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, not looking for any satellites, I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF. I'm in the newsroom in the City of Angels.
For his part, ZS1IBI says that his group of amateur astronomers feel that they're doing a service to the public by providing to them what they really need to know. He added that they do not consider themselves a threat to security. He notes that anyone else can do exactly the same thing. You can read the entire South African Sunday Times story online at tinyurl.com/2CWV7HV. With thanks to Allen Labs, AMSAT, the ARRL, the CGC Communicator, CQ Magazine, the FCC, the Ohio Penn DX Bulletin, Radio Netherlands, RAIN, the RSGB, the Southgate News, and Australia's WIA News. That's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline. Our email address is newsline@arnewsline.org. More information is available at Amateur Radio Newsline's only official website located at www.arnewsline.org. You can also write to us or support us at Amateur Radio Newsline, 28197 Robin Avenue, Santa Clarita, California, 91350. For now, with Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF at the editor's desk, I'm Don Wilbanks, AE5DW in South Mississippi, saying 73, and we thank you for listening. Amateur Radio Newsline is copyright 2010. All rights are reserved.
Are you going to bed soon? Are you going to be up all night?
A little of you.
each.
Okay, I'm just playing on the computer.
Same here.
Yeah, I got to get ready for a graduation I'm going to tomorrow, so I have to look up the information and see what this place is.
What's your best guess as to how soon Paul will come back? And was his last visit encouraging enough to excite another one?
Yeah, that's true. It's, there's talk about it, but I don't know what's happening right now. Nothing's going on as far as I know.
Does seem like a waste, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I guess that's the way life is.
I think the biggest problem is no one certain person in charge.
Yeah, it's true. It's been like that, a long time.
Everyone's afraid to stick their neck out for fear they'll be blamed for wasting money.
Yeah, and it's funny because the government may shut down this week, too.
This is what, New York State?
Yeah. I don't know. Patterson is not too happy.
What power has he got to correct it?
I don't think he has any power.
Who else in his position would have the power to correct it?
That's a good question. It's interesting. I guess, whoever the majority leaders are, I guess there's only one leader.
Who's the one leader?
That's a good question, too. Yeah, so, we'll see what happens. So I had an interesting weekend. Went to a party last night and a flea market today. What a contrast.
Yeah, how was the flea market today, from your point of view?
Well, they're all the same to me. I mean, I don't walk around. I just set up my table and that's it. They all look the same. I can't tell the difference. As far as the crowd is concerned, it didn't seem to be that crowded. Then again, Weimar wasn't that crowded either. It's not like dating or anything like that. It was just, it was fair.
Time I look it up, they say 0 to 50 kilohertz, so I'm a little confused.
but a very handy instrument. You can select any res bandwidth you want down to a millihertz. Yes, it is. Hewlett Packard.
Do you happen to have one?
For a short period of time, I had the use of one. Don't have one now, but I would love to have one.
Oh, is that what Wesley has?
He has the next cousin up from it, but his is really a scanning oscillator type spectrum analyzer, not the ubiquitous type.
Yeah, I see. So, that's awfully low frequency for you.
Yeah, but there are times when you want to resolve a weak signal in the noise, and the signal is in the noise of your system somewhere between 0 and 100 kilohertz.
That's true. I suppose if you're doing radar and that kind of stuff, it comes in real handy, doesn't it?
Yeah, it turns out that a real good range Doppler matrix, a airborne Doppler radar, can get down to millihertz of resolution and sensitivities of like minus 145 dBm.
How do you get those kinds of sensitivities? I mean, you know, just about everything makes noise down there.
Yeah, but if you're coherently looking for your own radar pulses, a pulse Doppler radar is carefully timing everything to its own transmitted pulses, the phase, angle, and amplitude of its own pulses. It's doing two different kinds of simultaneous integration, coherent and incoherent integration. And it's also comparing adjacent pixels of the picture it's generating. So it can get down to at least minus 135, 137 dBm.
No liquid nitrogen involved, right?
None at all. Synchronous demodulation in a vector manner can do all kinds of magic.
Yeah, well, it brings you digital television.
I believe it. And I think I told you I built a capacitive measuring system a couple of years ago. It only operated at 1 megahertz, but because it had synchronous demodulation, it could see signals so weak that I could measure 10 to the minus 5 picofarad in a 50 millisecond period with a reasonably high signal-to-noise ratio. And when you calculate what that thing was really doing, it was literally counting 17 electrons at a time on each half cycle.
That's very cute. Of course, the synchronization came from the device that created the pulse, yes?
Absolutely. There was a medium stability, 1 megahertz free-running oscillator in there, but everything was synchronized to that oscillator. And you know the way a capacitance measuring thing or an ohm meter works, you have to put a signal through the unknown in order to measure the current drop or the voltage drop. So when you measure capacitance in that manner, the capacitor was put into a Wheatstone bridge. That started off giving you a high signal-to-noise ratio. There was an equal capacitor, what I call the surrogate capacitor, as well as the unknown capacitor. They were essentially matched, so therefore very minor changes in the unknown would unbalance the bridge. That gave you a huge signal-to-noise ratio input improvement. All of the stages of amplification were dual differential operational amplifiers, differential input, differential output, and then that was followed by a synchronous demodulator. You put it all together, and boy, you've got three different ways there of canceling the noise, if you know what I mean. You're not integrating the noise out. You just never get it in the first place.
Yeah, I suppose with today's thinking, we could take a different approach to that. Megahertz? We'd have no problem digitizing that. How much resolution do you want? Let's see, you're talking about, you said 17 electrons, did you say? Well, we can do that with just some math without all that circuitry.
Yes and no. But don't forget those 17 electrons going in and out on each half cycle of the 1 meg wave are accompanied by all kinds of sources of noise. So you do need the Wheatstone Bridge to cancel some of the common mode noise. You need the dual differential op lamps to calculate, to cancel any of the noise picked up by the individual stages. And when you looked at the signal going into the synchronous demodulator, it looked noisy as all hell. But the synchronous demodulator only looked for the signal in the noise that correlated to the main reference oscillator and ignored everything else. So it didn't require a big integration factor. As I said, it had 50 millisecond time constant and high signal-to-noise ratio while measuring 10 to the minus 5 picofarads at 1 megacycle. A 10 to the minus 5 picofarad change sitting on top of 8-tenths of a pico.
Oh, I understand. What did you do about temperature compensation? Did you put it in a temperature-controlled little package?
Okay. In the case of a Wheatstone bridge, what do you have to worry about changing in temperature? In case of well-balanced op-amps, what do you have to worry about with reference to temperature? In case of a synchronous demodulator, the only thing that was temperature-sensitive is the sine wave oscillator, which was built with op-amps. To make a pure sine wave oscillator, you're on the hairy edge of too much feedback or not enough feedback. Too much feedback, it starts becoming a square wave. Not enough feedback, it stops oscillating. So I was temperature sensitive as far as the sine wave oscillator was concerned. And I was going to put a servo loop around that. But other than that, the rest of the circuitry, I could aim hot or cold substances at every one of the stages and nothing happened.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking about the unknown, using a reference for a Wheatstone bridge, if that moves a little bit. But wouldn't that cause it to go out of balance a little bit?
The unknown was the smallest gigatrim capacitor made by Johansson. It's a capacitor that goes from 1.2 picofarad maximum down to something like 2/10 of a picofarad. And it does that with something like 10 turns of this piston trimmer capacitor, ceramic gold-plated piston trimmer capacitor. In order to calibrate that thing, I put that on a Hewlett-Packard RLC meter, and then I figured out exactly how many picofarad change you had for each eighth of a turn on that piston trimmer. And that's how I measured the sensitivity of the thing.
Interesting. And this was for a radar system of some form.
No, that was for a background limited focal plane array detector. That detector, in theory, would have cryogenic sensitivity even though it runs at room temperature. Each of the pixels, you were measuring the capacitance change of a pixel because the pixel would change shape as a function of temperature. No wires were required to go to the pixel. Therefore, the outside world didn't dump heat into the pixel. Over to you.
Oh, I get it. This was some kind of, let's call it a full-body scanner.
This was a proof of concept. We built a one-megacycle version.